everyone, and welcome to the Malthouse Games Podcast. My name is Delton. I'll be your host today, and with me, as usual, is my lovely wife and yellow player, Haley.
Howdy, howdy, howdy. We have turned on the happy, as Delton says.
We've turned on the happy. This is episode number 168 of the Malthouse Games Podcast. We are a podcast all about board games, card games, role-playing games, tabletop games, dice games, things of that sort. And this morning, yes, I said morning, coffee.
Yes, so for one reason or another, we are recording approximately 2 hours and 20 minutes before this episode is to release. Therefore, it is Sunday morning. Therefore, we will not be drinking any beer today because that is not a great way to start off a Sunday morning, in my opinion. But I do want to thank our mysterious Ben, a factor, for prepping us for the next few episodes. Because how many beers we got, Delty?
So far, we have picked up 8 IPAs from here. I guess all are from Oklahoma except for one from Odell and one from Tups.
Yes, and Odell's out of Colorado and Tups is from Texas.
Yes, which we love Tups generally, and so we wanted to grab that. So we have 8 beers right now. We are trying to find a place that has another single selection because there is a brewery here in town, Skydance, which we've had a couple beers on the show. They do so many IPAs all the time, and we actually have one that we got for this, that Ben, I think you will love, that is a hazy quadruple IPA coming in at a whopping 10% ABV.
And the greatest thing about Skydance is that all of their beers are tall boys.
Yes. So that's going to be a hopefully delicious beer. I saw it and I saw quadruple IPA and I said, yes.
Yes, ma'am.
So we'll be able to have those beers coming up in the future on the next several episodes at this point, which, like I said, we have 8 beers right now. We still have funds left, so we're going to be going and finding more beers coming up sometime shortly in the next few weeks. Once we start getting lower, once we figure out where a place is, we will get more.
And we have already planned our next couple of podcast episodes, so we will not be coming to you live on Sunday morning, and so we'll actually be able to have beer.
Yes, because Sunday mornings, you know, there's no blame. There's no finger can be pointed on whose fault it is this Sunday. Not at all.
Not at all.
Not a single finger can be pointed.
Nope. Nobody here has difficulties with executive functioning.
Nope.
Not one bit.
Not at all. And nobody here falls asleep at 8:30 p.m. So
nope, not at all.
You know, this is how life works, folks. But yes, this morning we're drinking coffee from Aldi because that's still who we are. It's delicious. It's French press. I love it. We love it.
Organic fair trade Honduras coffee for $5.95, my dudes.
We have never researched those keywords on the front of the packaging, but I believe it because it's Aldi.
I trust Aldi. I trust them with my nourishment.
But aside from that, the last time we talked to you was like the night before Easter.
Yes. And so the last podcast launched on Easter Sunday. And so Easter Sunday, we woke up and the Easter Bunny miraculously appeared in our house. My God. Lakin, my niece was staying with us that weekend, and so my sister had brought all the Easter basket stuff. And man, props to moms. Like, to do all of, or parents in general, moms, dads, parents, guardians, whatever, doing all that planning for all the holidays. Because yep. Riley had to hide all of the Easter stuff in Elk City, transport it with her child up here to our house, find a way to sneak it into our house with her ever-observant child, and surprise her with the Easter celebration on Sunday morning without her even knowing. And so she made out like a bandit. She got squishmallows. She got candy. She got all the stuff that my little 90s kid heart was really jealous of. So she made out like a bandit. That it was really neat to be a part of a kiddo's Easter morning, too. I love that we're able to be involved in her traditions. And I also love that we don't have to pay for it.
What was your favorite, like, Easter basket or Easter gift as a kid?
Oh, man. My grandma and grandpa would, Grandma B and Papa Bill, they would always give us awesome Easter baskets. And one year they gave me one that had it's like the cheap art stuff. You know, the little art kits that were like $12, but had like really brittle watercolor and chalk and all that jazz. I loved that. Absolutely loved that. I got an Easter basket. It was just full of that stuff. What about you?
My favorite, I don't remember how old I was, I got a hot glue gun.
Hell yeah.
I wanted a hot glue gun so badly, and so I just started sticking shit on other shit, and that was just what I did, and I loved it.
Why did you want a hot glue gun? Like, what was the specific reason?
It was cool.
You put a
stick of glue in the back, and you squeeze the trigger, and it comes out liquidy, and you can glue stuff together, and I don't know. I think we used one at school sometime, and I just wanted one so badly for arts and crafts, and that's what it was.
How did we not burn our houses down?
I don't know.
Because I had one of those too, and like there was no safeties on it. Like if you left it plugged in, it would just stay hot forever.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It had like the little brittle, flimsy kickstand that would,
yep.
If you just thought about it too hard, it would fall over.
That's like, why many a tables in our generation have little black spots on them from the tips of hot glue guns burning.
I mean, someone was smiling down upon us that our houses had not burst into flames at least 8 times through the years, 1995, 1999, with those hot glue guns.
Well, especially like my house that was a freaking barracks at Fort Reno converted into a home, so they had to take this building, add a kitchen, add like good plumbing, and then add electric on top of that. And that had been redone a time or two, and it wasn't the greatest.
And probably not by a licensed professional either.
I think he was, actually.
Oh, was
he? My dad's buddy who does carpentry.
Nice.
So I think it was. But yeah, that house, I don't know how it's still standing, but it is. Hooray.
Hurrah. And so since then, so we had Riley and Lakin up that weekend, and then we had a pretty chill week. Both of us went to the dentist, wild and crazy time, and Riley came to stay with us another week. Her work is out in Elk City, but she was having to come to meetings in Oklahoma City, and so she just pocketed that per diem for the hotel room and stayed with us, and we got ice cream all the time. We hung out, had a grand old time, and then yesterday just played some games with some friends.
We did. I know that I've talked about this in the past before, but speaking of the dentist, I had to have a cavity filled because my face hates me. And then because I had a filling that chipped. So they pulled the old filling out and they were filling two very small cavities before they got bad. And they were filling one behind that one while they were drilling it. And all of a sudden, apparently like a third of my tooth just popped off. So they had to do a core filling to basically say in the future, you're going to need a crown. You might have to have a root canal, depending on how it does between then and like now and then. I don't know. I'm tired of it. The filling's got a sharp edge on it, and I keep hurting my tongue.
It's time for dentures.
At this point, put me to sleep, knock them all out, and replace them. I am done with these teeth.
I'm going to join Hollywood with your veneers.
I literally floss twice a day, brush twice a day, try to do good with your teeth. Guess what? They still suck.
I know. I'm so sorry.
It's fine. I'll just chew on rocks, and then I'll replace them. Wouldn't take much. And by rocks, I mean just anything crunchy. Yeah, so that was the dentist. That's a lot of fun. We played games yesterday, though, one of which we're going to talk about.
Oh, here's the door. It's straight ahead. It's a game.
P.S. My teeth were fine.
Haley's teeth are always fine. She sucks. You jerk. Okay, well, the game we played at Brian's yesterday was Underwater Cities. Underwater Cities is one that I had on my list for a long time to try, and Brian picked it up, and at some point, me and him played a two-player game. I could tell you when. I'm not going to look it up. It was a while ago, several years. So we busted it out last night, and me and Brian and Haley played, and we're able to get a three-player game in. Underwater Cities is designed by Vladimir Succi. It has artists Uldrim and Milan Vavrone. Graphic design by Radek Boxen. And editing and writing by Jason Holt. It is published by Delicious Games, I believe is the original. His version had the Rio Grande logo on it, which means I believe they brought that to the U.S. The other game, I knew I recognized the name Vladimir Succi, but could not remember. He also did Last Will, which me and Haley enjoy.
Yes, we did. We reviewed that one early on in the podcast, right?
It's been a long... We need to play it with the expansion that I have. I think I have both of them. What? No, there's just one. Anyway, we need to play it at some point with that. But yeah, so Underwater Cities is a Euro game. It can hold 1 to 4 players, so it does have a solo mode for you solo fans. And the playtime on the box estimates 40 minutes per player. We actually weren't too far off from that, were we?
No, I don't think so. I think it maybe took like, I don't know,
it was
2.5 hours for us to play.
It was just over 2.5. So it really wasn't too far off from that, but it's also... I hadn't played it in forever, Brian hadn't played it in forever, and Haley had never played it.
And I was playing after 8:30 p.m.
Yes, after 8:30 p.m. and a Topo Chico or two earlier in the day. So it took a little longer than it probably would if we sat down right now and played it. But it is a pretty weighty game in terms of like complexity, but not in the way that you play. It's complex in how you play well, which I always enjoy with games. So the way the game's going to work is you have a little board in front of you where you can place... essentially cities that are like domes because you're building underwater cities, remember, by the title. You have tunnels to travel between them, and you have essentially like desalination plants, laboratories, and like farms where you can produce food. Some of them produce money or biomatter, which can make better cities and things like that. It is also going to be a game that focuses on cards pretty heavily, but also has a slight sort of worker placement element involved. So on your turn, you will take an action. There is a main board where we keep track of scores and turn order and things like that. There, you will take an action by placing one of your little door tokens, which is essentially a worker in functionality. You take one of your little worker door tokens and you will place it in one of the areas of either green, red, or orange. The green, red, or orange color on those doesn't actually do anything separate for the action of that space. What it does, though, is every time you place one of your little action worker door guys onto a space, you will discard a card from your hand. If the card is a different color, so if I placed it on green, one of the green spaces, and I discarded a red card, it's just going to go to discard. However, if I went to a red space and discarded a red card, I then get to either use the red card for its one-time action. If it's one of those instant cards, it could go in front of me in my tableau for an infinite ability that's always available and running. Or it can be an action card itself that goes in front of me to where when I take a specific worker placement spot that allows me to activate one of my action cards, I could use it in a future turn. There are also some cards that do specific things for the three production phases in the game. There's one after it's you do four rounds or four, I guess, turns or rounds, however it's phrased. And then production, three, production, three, production, game. So you've got some that help you with production. And there are also cards, especially the special ones that you can purchase through a specific action, that are in-game scoring or just very strong abilities of some sort. So on your turn, you'll place one of your little workers on either the green, the red, or the orange. You will discard a card, preferably of the same color. You'll take all the equivalent actions in whatever order you want, as long as you resolve the card in its totality or the space in its totality before you move on. And then it goes to the next player. You're going to be getting points for cities that are built, that have connecting tunnels to them, that have connecting laboratories and farms and stuff like that, as well as the points that you get in each production phase based on several different factors of upgraded tunnels and upgraded labs and farms and things like that. But that's kind of the gist of the game. You're essentially building a little bit of a tableau while also doing some worker placement and also building out where you're placing these things on your board and trying to get the right resources at the right time and trade things in and do all that kind of stuff. And it's a thinker, but it's a very fun game.
It is, and it really wasn't as complex whenever we sat down to play as what I was expecting.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those games where they lay everything out and you have to, you know, take into consideration, you know, what your opponents are going to be taking in regards to actions. Turn order is very important. You have to make sure that your engine's running smoothly and that, you know, things build off each other. But once we actually sat down to play, it was really simple. After the first three turns in the first round, like, okay, we're good to go.
Yeah, when you first sit down, it is definitely information overload, especially the little card, which Brian pointed this out at the end, the little card that says, here's what you can build and here's how much it costs. During production, here's what you're going to get. If it's upgraded, here's what you're going to get. Special cases, here's what you're going to get. So it's just this little card that's probably, I don't know, how big do you think that was? Like a 4x2, 4x3, 5x3?
It was like a large note card.
Yeah.
So like a 4x6.
Yeah. And it's just full of icons and little, you know, it's a graph broken down into sections. And it kind of seems like a lot at first, but once you get into the swing of it, after the first like three full rounds, I was like, okay, aside from me not knowing the best option to proceed with, it's not a difficult game. You're literally just, you're playing on a space, discarding a card. All the iconography like made sense. It all clicked, and there was very few times, only in really the special cases, where I'm like, I don't get what the hell this means. Like my Black Ops card that was one of my special cards with the infinite ability that just keeps running, which was basically if I go to a space, like let's say I choose an orange action space, but I don't discard an orange card, then my Black Ops card says if you go to a space and discard something that's not a matching color, you get one steel plast or steel plasty or whatever the steel resources. And so it benefited me if I needed to just dump a card or I needed an action really badly, I could still get a benefit and not just completely be wasting a card.
And I had the same card, but whenever I played in a spot that didn't match my color, I got one of the monies.
Yeah. So there's multiple things like that. It's definitely a game where there is going to be some luck of the draw, because you start with three cards, and every turn you'll spend one of them doing your action. Sometimes you can draw extra cards during the turn, but then at the end of your turn, every single turn, no matter how many cards are in your hand, you will draw one. So even though luck of the draw does come into play, I felt like I saw a lot of cards. So I was never, I guess I was spoiled for choice is what it felt like, because there's multiple actions on the board too, where you're like, you know what, I'm going to take this. It's not my favorite action, but not only do I get a money, and I also go up one on the reputation track that helps me on turn order, but I'm also going to draw two cards to fill my hand to help me pick something better for next turn sort of thing. And I really liked that, because I felt like I always had good choices and got to see lots of cards in the game, which is nice, because the cards really can dictate how well you do. If you get a really good, strong card, it's going to change your approach to your strategy, which is why I kept building tunnels for cheap and upgrading tunnels for cheap. And that was like a huge part of me getting points.
What's great about this game too is, you know, it's a big game. There's a lot going on, but if you are a new player or a sleepy player, then you still have a chance, because I'd never played before and I didn't win, but our point spread was what? 7 points?
Yeah, let me look. I can look real quick, because it was the last thing we played.
I think I had 68.
You had 68, I had 72, and Brian had 74.
Yeah, and so we sat down and played for, you know, 2 hours and 40 minutes or whatever, and that was our point spread at the very end.
And what's funny about that, too, is that both you and I and Brian all at different times in the game were like, well, this person's winning, I'm not doing very well. We all thought we weren't doing well enough, but then in the end, when you started calculating everything, it was very tight.
Yeah. A 6-point spread is all. It's crazy.
It's wild. And I love when games can do that, though, because it means your different approaches to how you're playing, your different approaches to strategy are all more viable, at least for beginner players, right? I've only played it twice. Brian's only played it 3 times now. You've played it once. But even within that, none of us are super experienced, but it still came in together, you know, so close in, of a spread. So I think they did a good job making all these different options viable, at least for players that don't know the game extremely well.
Absolutely.
This is one, though, that I would like to see how our approach and our strategies would change with experience in it. If we played this game 10 times, I wonder if we're like, that card, that's a trap card, don't touch it, like get rid of it, it sucks, or something. I wonder how it would change and expand, and what ways we could be more efficient, because there's all kinds of little spots in this game where someone takes your best action, but there is a less efficient approach to the exact same thing. It just might take working around, but you're never completely locked out of what you want to do.
Yes, because this game really does reward efficiency.
Yeah.
And so at first, you know, whenever you play a card, you do an action, or maybe you get a bonus action if you play the right color on the right thing. But by like round 6, 7, 8, you play a card, it triggers 5 or 6 other cards, and you're getting more resources, or you're getting more turns, or you're getting more actions, da-da-da-da-da-da.
It really is. It's one of those games that the more efficient you can be, the better you're going to be, which that is kind of every game ever, but also there just are games that it feels more important to have that efficiency. But this one does, and you know, I don't want to go into like super detail of the play, but just because that would take forever, because it is very weird. There was a few issues with the rule book of some strangeness, like what's considered connected to your network and how you can build. Because it's like you could build somewhere that's next to, like it's adjacent to a city or adjacent to a place where you could put a city. And it's like, well, where could you put a city? And is that like figuring out the networking is a disaster every time, at least the 2 times I've played it. That's always really, really weird based on the wording. And then there was one spot, the action cards that are actually like the kind that if you play on a green and you put down a green action card as your discard, it goes to your tableau. And at a later turn, if you take a space that allows you to use an action card, you could use it. Well, in the rule book, it tells you that, tells you the different cards. But then there's a section that says when you discard a card for your action, if it matches, you get to activate that action's ability or that card's ability before, you know, whatever. But it actually doesn't include those action cards because those must be activated at a later turn but it doesn't specify that in that paragraph. So the way that it words it, I have issues with. The rule book has some spots like that. But all in all, it makes sense in the rule book what you read. Just some of it's kind of weird, and I think the networking I need to figure out on my own if this was one I picked up at some point or something.
Bless BGG.com.
Yes, the rules forums are always helpful on BGG. But yeah, I mean, that's Underwater Cities. I really enjoyed the game. When I sat down, I did not remember what I had played before, aside from the little domes on the player board and stuff. But once we got into it, I was like, oh yeah, I remember. And then by the end of it, I was like, I'm tired, but I really like this game. So definitely check out Underwater Cities if you get a chance, and it sounds like something that would be for you. But one of the things in this game that I always seem to enjoy is when a game has a limited number of turns.
Hey, what can I get you?
I'd like a topic.
Any special way?
Make it a top shelf topic.
Coming up. Enjoy.
And so the topic for today's episode is games with limited terms. And so, turns. Because like Dalton said, Underwater Cities has a limited number of turns. And so whenever Brian introduced this game to us, one of the first things he said is from start to finish, you are going to play 30 turns. That is it. It is 10 rounds, 3 turns each, with some scoring or some resource gathering spread out between.
Yes, it is a game where, like Haley said, you start round 1, you get 3 turns, and then you basically recall your workers and you start round 2. And then you go to round 3 and you do that, and you play exactly 30 turns in this game. So it's very limited. By the time you get through, with round 5, you're like, okay, we're halfway. But it's actually a legitimate halfway. And there's something about that that I always enjoy in games. I like having that restriction of it's not just who hits a point value first. It's not a tug of war, because I like games like that. I mean, that's, you know, I love Pax Pamir, and Pax Pamir is the first person to do, you know, X or Y. And it could be just kind of however long. But it is also really nice to sit down with a game and they say, all right, you're taking 30 actual actions. That's it. Get ready. And there's something fun about that that I enjoy.
Yes, I think it kind of goes back to rewarding efficiency again. Because, like, I think about, so earlier in the day, yesterday, we played Century Spice Road, which is another one of our favorites. We've reviewed the Gollum edition.
Yeah.
We got that one at the first Gen Con we attended. Woo. But we played the regular Century Spice Road yesterday. And the way that the game ends is the first person to achieve 5 of the scoring cards. And so it's challenging because it's kind of a race. So whoever gets the 5 first, you're having the balance between, you know, do I race for these smaller scoring cards or do I hold out for these larger scoring cards? Not that it's bad. And Century Spice Road is one of our favorites, but it's challenging to kind of plan your turns a little bit longer because you don't know exactly when the game is going to end.
Yeah, you really don't. You can try to assume based on what people are collecting cube-wise or resource-wise in that one. But even with that, it's hard to say if they're actually doing what you think they're doing and whatnot. But yeah, those kind of games add that stress level to them. They have that, oh, they might be ending it. I probably should not do my long plan. It comes back around. Oh, they didn't end it. Well, shoot, now I've abandoned my long plan and I'm doing something that I didn't really want to do. It adds a lot of that, which is, you know, just part of that style of game. But having those strict turns, it eliminates that stress. That race to it and that decision-making where you're no longer concerned about, well, should I do this or should I do this because of when the game's going to end? It's how should I do this to progress further, faster? So it's almost just shifts your viewpoint from when should I do it to how should I do it? And I like
yes.
that.
And, you know, from a research perspective, when we have constraints, like we have well-known constraints, like we know what our limits are and whatnot, that can actually fuel that creativity too. Because think about it too, we're not spending a lot of mental time, you know, looking at everyone else's boards, trying to figure out, you know, how much time do I have left? We're spending a lot of that mental energy, you know, on our own player board, our own goals and whatnot, but also we know what the end point is. And so that can also be motivating too.
Oh, absolutely. I've always said this with music, like with my drumming, is limitations really do motivate or help with creativity. So I've always said, if I sit at a drum set and you say, play me something, I don't know. But if I sit down at the drum set and you said, I want, you know, eighth notes on the hi-hat and four on the floor, I know exactly what that sounds like and how to then turn that into something interesting. Because that constraint, or hey, don't touch the cymbals, only play on the toms. Okay, now I've got something more to work for. You've limited my scope, which means I need to be more creative to make it interesting. And it's kind of the same thing. But I've always talked about that with music, that limitations really help creativity. And that is the same with games, I think, in a way.
And if we think about like goal planning and whatnot, so there's this goal planning method called SMART goals. And if you've, you know, been to therapy or you've read any self-help books, you probably are familiar with it. But SMART is specific, measurable, attainable, reasonable, and timely. And the reason why we put timely on there, that T is very important, because the research suggests if we have an endpoint to our goals, that we're more motivated and we're more creative whenever it comes to reaching them. And so we're not spending, you know, a lot of mental energy, you know, wondering when it's going to end, but we have this endpoint that, okay, I need to achieve this by this date. In the case of these games, okay, I have 30 turns to get what I want to get done. And so that really provides like this anchor point for us to put our energy into, I guess.
That makes sense. It feels like it's not only that anchor point, but then it also helps you stay focused on it.
Yes, have to stay focused because you know exactly how many turns you have left. You know exactly. So it's like, I think about halfway through the game, whenever we've figured it out, we have our goals in mind. Okay, I have 16 turns left to complete this. And you're starting to map out exactly, you're starting to break down the goal naturally. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, my goal is to win the game. You know, here are my steps I need to take in order to do so.
Yeah, and you're really trying to say, okay, how soon can I get to this point, which allows me to get to this point, which allows me to then do this for big points at the end of the game? And you start, yeah, like you said, naturally breaking that process down and deciding on, okay, here's my timeline now. I need to achieve this by this time and this by this time to finish up all of it by the end.
And not that you can't do that in other games, like Century Spice Road. You could do that in Century Spice Road. In fact, I think we all do it. But you're, again, not wasting that mental energy on trying to metagame it, like, okay, how long is this game going to last? What are they doing? Are they going to try and end it early? Oh, they're already at 3 cards. You know, am I going to be able to save up in enough time to get that 19-point card? Like, you're just wasting, you're not using as much cognitive energy. I think it makes it feel more like a multiplayer solitaire, because the end of the game is not dependent on other people.
Yeah, the only time with like Underwater Cities, that the only thing you really care about with others is just if they take the action spot you want. Mm-hmm. But that's 99% of games that have worker spaces. So that doesn't bother me at all in that regard, right? But yeah, it really is essentially just a multiplayer solitaire aside from that one aspect. And I guess the special in-game scorecards, but I don't even think, did you even grab one of those?
I grabbed one, but I don't think I scored it.
Didn't get nothing for it?
I don't remember.
I don't either. But like, yeah, there's so little interaction between players that it doesn't really matter with Underwater Cities. But that's something that other games that have this limited turn structure, they usually have something like that where the only interaction is, oh, they took what I wanted, so I'm going to have to just change it a little bit, such as Pipeline, which has a limited number of rounds. And in those rounds, a limited number of turns. I don't remember how many total for each different player count. I think it changes, but that's another one where you're trying to be efficient and do all that kind of stuff.
And like looking at the games that we play that hit the table the most, I think we tend to gravitate more towards those games. Because like Quax, that's another one where it's very limited. You know that you have, what is it, eight rounds you're going through?
I think nine?
Eight or nine.
Eight or nine.
And so the same thing with Calico. You know exactly how many turns. Why do you think this is just my observation from having thought about this topic for the last hour or so, but Why do you think we tend to gravitate towards those?
I think part of it is it's easy or not easy. I there's two things in my head right now. One of which is for two players, which is majority of the time what we play, the kind of games where you're worried if the other opponent is going to end it faster, I just don't like as much, right? The only one that seems to be okay with that is Patchwork, because somebody could end it faster, but it's a little different.
But there's a lot of catch-up mechanic there.
There is. So I think that one of them is, as two players, having something where you're worried about, is your opponent trying to race the end? Are they pushing it this and that? Isn't as fun, at least for me, at just two players. The other one is that games that have a limited number of turns or a specific number of turns are much easier to fit into a schedule of your week.
That is very true. as even though it might vary on how long a turn might take, depending on how much AP is involved, you still have a better idea of how long a game will take.
Yeah, you have a decent... I mean, if you sit down with Calico and you're like, all right, I think it's 24 tiles you get to place, you can look at your board and be like, all right, we're halfway there. And you're always placing one tile. Whether it works for you or not, you're always placing it. So you have a timer. And you can work a little faster if you need. But like you said, no matter what, turns might take a little different. But I feel like the gameplay time is a little bit more... It's not an exact, but it's a smaller range than the other type of games. Unless one of us decides to just rush to the end. That's the only time that really is, you know, could be much, much faster. But I think that for me, that's probably it.
I think that's a good point because, like you said, we're having to fit gameplay into a schedule, whether it is Haley's brain shuts off at 8:30 or, you know, sister's coming to stay or we have this plan with friends or, hey, it's a late work night, so on and so forth.
Or I'm tired from work.
Tired from work. Not working from home today. Da, 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 da.
Yeah, I think that all comes into play. And then the other thing I thought about just now that I think is we've also both talked about in the past with our gaming values on episode 149, which is also when we talked about Bamboo. We both like kind of problem solving or puzzle solving kind of games. And I feel like ones with a limited number of turns is like a puzzle with a limited number of pieces. You're trying to figure it out and solve with what's there. You don't have to worry about extra things being thrown in. And even though I'm bad at that kind of stuff, I still enjoy it. And so those type of games, I think, ring more true in that regard.
I agree.
Yeah.
And so tell us, what do you prefer? Do you prefer games with limited amount of turns? Or do you prefer the more ambiguous ending? Sorry, guys. I have half a cup of coffee.
Yes.
We're still getting fueled up.
Yeah, we're still getting fueled up, getting all going. One thing I'll add, but yes, let us know what you prefer. If you prefer more to the direction of whoever gets to the, you know, X amount of points first wins, or if you prefer, here's how many turns we're going to play and whoever has the best points at the end wins. I do like though, and I'm looking at Gugong, as you know, I adore Gugong. One of the things with that game is it's technically a limited number of turns because there's like four rounds and you'll end up playing through all of your cards. However, there's the option of adding the ability to have extra cards. So even though it's limited, you can add one or two more turns per player depending on how it's played. So I do like that that's kind of a mix of the two a little, but still more leaning toward limited turns. But that's, you know, neither here nor there. I just do find that interesting because that also works for me.
And it's a fun game.
And it's a fun game. But yes, that's the topic. Let's get to the question so I can get to editing and see if I can get this out on time.
I believe in you.
And now, join us for a Malt House Games podcast special, Pint-Size Question.
So, the question for today is going to be, what goals that we've been working toward are we currently happy with the progress?
Yes, so do you want to go first, Delty?
Sure. Obviously, we've talked about this on the show, I think, a time or two now. But next year, in 2025, for our 10-year wedding anniversary, we are taking a long vacation to Japan.
3 weeks, baby. I have not been off work for more than 2 weeks since I was 14.
Yeah.
This will be the longest I have been off of work, and by that point, 20 years.
I think that we'll be gone. Are we gone for like 19 days?
Gone for 19 days.
In Japan for 17 nights?
18 nights.
Is it 18 nights? Because we leave on a Saturday, but we don't get there till a Sunday.
We've got 16 nights booked. 2 nights left.
Yep. So we'll be there for 18 nights. We have 16 nights of accommodations booked and ready to go. And then we've got two more we're waiting on because the hotel that we want only opens up about 9 months before. Like, that's how far out you can book. And so we're having to wait for that to get much closer because it's going to be next March. But we've been planning that and been looking at that. And starting in September of 2022, I started our savings plan, calculated out to where we would have a sufficient amount of funds to afford all of Japan and hopefully come back with excess. I have since increased said savings plan to ensure that even with potential rising costs, because flights have gone up since then.
Inflation!
And everything like that, even though the yen is weak right now. It's been doing really well. Our savings on Japan has been uninterrupted and, like I said, even have bolstered it with extra. And it's going to be a fantastic trip for not only our anniversary, but just in general getting to explore a country like Japan and go to several big cities over a long period of time using almost all of my vacation days that I, which is why this year is going to be such a tame vacation year, sadly. But it will be great. I'm very excited. It's going to be an amazing trip where we never have to say no if there's something we want to do. And that's what I want. So I'm very, very happy with how that's progressed. And if we had to stop right now and couldn't save any more for it, we could still afford accommodation flights and should be able to, if we planned it correctly, all of our food and even souvenirs and come out okay. So I'm very happy with that.
Thank you, Delty.
Yeah, it's taken a lot of work and a lot of dedication to saying, I don't need it for other stuff. But it's good. How about you?
So for me, something that I'm making progress on is learning to read Japanese. And so I have almost got all the hiragana done. I still get mixed up a bit with the re and the ri, but you know what? We're getting there. I can basically read hiragana. Don't always know what it says, but I can pronounce it and say it out loud.
It's like you can pronounce it all, but you just might not know what the actual words are.
Yeah, so next is katakana. And so once I get more comfortable with the hiragana, I'll move on to the katakana, which is used a lot for writing English derived words.
Yeah, any borrowed words, but also sometimes emphasis too, kind of like italics, I found out.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
And so that will be next. So I'm making progress on that, making progress on my conversation. And then Delty's going to be working on the kanji because he's an angel.
Yeah, Haley's been doing really well with learning the grammar and how to speak small sentences and get that kind of stuff together. I am very, very bad at that. My hiragana has fallen off and I'm trying to get back to it, but it's very hard to learn a language that is so absolutely different from your own. If it was kind of similar, it would be much easier, but it is not.
Yes,
not at all.
The grammar is very different.
Yep.
And the borrowed words are easy, but there's not a lot of similarities between Japanese and English. But it's been enjoyable. It's one of my favorite things to do. It's kind of a mindfulness activity for me just to sit and study for a while. And so I've been grateful for that, making progress, still not quite there. Again, I can read it. Do I know what I'm saying? Nope. But you know what? I can read it.
Here's the best part. If you want to learn language, but it terrifies you of whether it's for Spanish, if it's like el or la, and you know, they have gendered nouns and things like that. Japanese, there's no gendered nouns. Japanese, you never say the or a.
There's
or
no plural.
There's no plural at all. If you say those are cats, it's just cat and you gesture wildly. Basically it's all very, very contextual.
Neko wa desu.
Yeah, that's cat. And it's very interesting in that regard, but it makes it way simpler. Like, it's a very complicated language because it's so absolutely different, but not having to learn the articles, is that what they are?
Yes.
And like the gendering way to approach different things. Oh, that in itself is so much better than when I was learning German, because German is like, you got to get it right. And I'm like, I don't want to.
Because you have your nominative, you have your dative, you have your direct object, indirect object, you have your gendered, you have your neutral. Like, there's basically like, I don't know, 8 or 9 different ways to say the in German, depending on the gender and the context in the sentence.
Yes, and if it's polite or if it's casual also changes things for that. And it's like, oh, God. But anyway, Japanese is easier for that. So, you know, I guess you choose your battles with languages.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, so I think that's going to be pretty much it for the episode. I want to thank our Patreon patrons. So thank you so much to Alan, Jennifer, and Cliff for supporting us on Patreon at a level in which you get shouted out on the podcast. If you want to be like them and our other amazing patrons, head to patreon.com/malthousegames.
And thank you so much to our benefactor, Ben, for giving us some beer money.
Yes.
And also shout out to Brian for giving us the idea for today's topic. Inadvertently.
Inadvertently, he did, for sure. So if you have any questions you want to ask us, anything you want us to answer on the episode, topics to cover, games we should look at, beers we should find, send an email, contact@malthousegames.com. You can also find us on social media at Malthouse Games, MALTHAUS Games. You can find Haley at
SQUIRRELYGEK.
That's at Squirrely Geek. I think that covers everything, though. I've got about an hour and a half if I want to stick on my timeline of getting this out on noon on a Sunday, which is my usual. So
I believe in you.
I'm going to hop off here and go do some editing. So hopefully you enjoy. Thanks again for tuning in and listening. Until next time, sit back, relax, grab a drink, and play some games. We'll see you folks later.
Goodbye.
Bye.